The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a program that enrolls Alabamians in the health insurance marketplace. Navigators provide free local in-person support to all applicants. Enroll Alabama, 256-432-7494, 256-432-7494.
Welcome to this special edition of the Healthy Alabama podcast, sponsored by Enroll Alabama. And produced in partnership with Oakwood University Radio, Praise 90.1 FM, WJOU. I'm David Person. This episode is part one of my interview with Dr. David Williams, world-renowned sociologist based at Harvard University. It was conducted on February the 8th, 2018, before a live audience in the Peters Media Center on the Oakwood University campus. We are here with Dr. David R. Williams. He is the Florence Sprague Norman and Laura Smart Norman Professor of Public Health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and he is the Professor of African and African American Studies and Sociology at Harvard University. He's a member of the National Academy of Medicine, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is recognized as a global leader in the development of health policies. Also, and I think this will resonate, Dr. Williams, especially with our millennials, he has a TED Talk that was recorded in 2016 that has been viewed more than 1 million times. So let's give a warm welcome, Oakwoodites, to Dr. David Williams.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's start with a very simple question, Dr. Williams. You have developed something called the Everyday Discrimination Scale. Can you explain what that is and why it's relevant?
So when my career started, most researchers believed that racial differences in health were simply a function of racial differences in income and education and occupational status. And that if we look at blacks and whites at the same level of income and education, there would be no effect of race. And then we began to look at research that documented at every level of income and education, there still is an added negative impact of race on health. And so it led us to ask the question, what else is it about race that matters? And I thought that racism might be a part of it. And in my TED Talk, I give the history of how I got there, of thinking that we need to develop measures to capture different aspects of racism. And I remember reviewing a book that had come out in the early 1990s on the health, it was called Health Issues in the Black Community. And I was a reviewer of that book for a journal. And I was struck that the book had more than 25 chapters, and almost every single chapter mentioned racism or discrimination was a determinant of African-American health, and I agreed with them. I thought they were absolutely right. But not one of those chapters offered a shred of evidence or even made a logical case of the ways in which racism might matter. And I felt, from a scientific point of view, especially from the brethren of lighter hue who are skeptical of what we say, I said, this is not good enough. They're going to laugh at us, because how can we be as certain that racism matters without operationalizing racism, measuring it, and using their tools of science documenting that racism mattered? And I remember speaking at a conference in D.C., a National Center for Health Statistics conference on minority health, and there's a final panel with one black person, one Native American person, one Latino person, and one Asian person to talk about what were the needs in the field. And I was a black person that day. And I said one of the things we needed to do as we look to the future was to document the role that racism played in health. And a gentleman got up in the audience and said, I agree with Dr. Williams that racism is important, but what he's asking us to do is impossible. Racism cannot be measured. And I remember looking at this gentleman and saying to him that if you say to me, do we have good, valid, and reliable measures to assess racism, I would say no. But I would say I see no reason why we couldn't measure racism. I said we measure self-esteem. If we measure self-esteem, why can't we develop measures of racism? And that was the final kind of spur. I was thinking about this already the fact that we're saying racism matters without evidence, and now someone is telling me it cannot be done, of course we can do it. And I went back and started to read the qualitative literature by sociologists like Joe Fagan, who is a white scholar but has done a lot of seminal work on the nature of racism in American society and has interviewed middle-class African-Americans and other African-Americans to document their experiences of racism. And I read the work of another scholar, Philomena Essed, a Dutch scholar from the Netherlands who was an immigrant to the Netherlands from the South American country of Suriname. And she did qualitative work again, tracing the experiences of black people in the Netherlands and African-American women in California and describing their experiences. And as I read them, I was taking notes. How do we put these experiences into questions that people could respond to? And so I developed three scales to assess different aspects of discrimination. One I call the major experiences of discrimination scale that captures things like, have you ever been unfairly fired? Have you ever been stopped, physically threatened, or abused by the police? You know, trying to capture the experiences that people had. But those are big things. If you read the rich qualitative literature of on discrimination, discrimination is not just in those big things. It's packaged and patterned into the day-to-day experiences of individuals. I'll give you one example. This very morning, at a hotel here in Huntsville, going for breakfast, I am walking into the little restaurant area where we go and have breakfast, and two white ladies sitting at their table getting their bill ready said, sir, to me, do we give you this? This is their check for the bill for their, and I'm... Do you give it to me? I just repeated the question. And then they realized, and then they said, do you work here? I said, no, I don't. And she says, oh, but you look so professional looking. But do you see, that is a little indignant. Now, this happens often enough. This is not the first time. I wish I could tell you this was the first time. It's not the first time. I'm in a hotel and people are asking me, where is the hairdresser, or can I take this to their room, or some other thing. You know, yes. So I wanted to capture those day-to-day experiences. And so the everyday discrimination scale captures, some people are using the term microaggressions. At the time I developed this in the early 1990s, the microaggression paper had not yet been written, but it is capturing what many would call microaggressions. In your day-to-day life, how often are you treated with less courtesy than others? How often are you treated with less respect than others? How often do people act like you're not smart? How often do people act as if they're afraid of you? It's just those little indignities on a day-to-day basis. And what we have found is that the chronic stress of this everyday discrimination is a powerful predictor of poor health.
So you said you have developed three scales.
Yes.
That's one.
That's one. I first give the major experiences. Okay. Have you been unfairly stopped, physically threatened, or abused by the police? Is one. Have you ever been unfairly fired, unfairly denied a promotion? It's big things in different domains of life. The everyday discrimination is the second one. The third one, the research on discrimination, similar to the research on stress, we are negatively affected by stress, not only by what has happened to us, but what might happen to us that we're worried about. And we are ruminating and thinking about and preparing ourselves for these things that just might happen. So I developed a scale called the heightened vigilance scale. And I'll tell you, the first time I thought about it and the background of the vigilance scale came from that reading, but it also came from other experiences I had. When I was a professor at Yale, I remember this really struck me powerfully. One evening I was watching the evening news, the local news, and it showed in one of New Haven's neighborhoods. New Haven was one of the 10 poorest cities in America at the time, even though it was the home to one of the wealthiest universities in the country, Yale University, which was my employer. But it showed an African-American woman was being interviewed, and she talked about the violence in her neighborhood. And she said that because of all of this violence, she and her son sleep on the floor every night. They have a bed, but they don't sleep on the bed, they sleep on the floor. Because she thought that being on the floor was safer. The bullets were less likely to hit her or her son, a stray bullet, while she was sleeping, if they were on the floor versus being on the bed. And I stopped to think, what does that mean physiologically? When, even when you are going to sleep, you are thinking, preparing for what might be happening even while you sleep. And I thought back to the fact that there had been at that time several studies of what is called ambulatory blood pressure measures. An ambulatory blood pressure study is where we hook you up to a little machine that at random intervals during the day will take your blood pressure. And what those studies had found in multiple cities in the United States among normotensive black and white young people, so they're healthy people with no hypertension, they found that there was no racial difference in blood pressure among African Americans compared to whites during the day. But there was a racial difference in blood pressure at night when blacks and whites were sleeping. And that is, at night, everyone has what we call a nocturnal decline in blood pressure. You go to sleep, you're resting, your body relaxes, your blood pressure goes down. That happened for blacks and that happened for whites. However, the decline for African Americans was much smaller than the decline for whites, so that African Americans maintained a higher level of blood pressure even while they were sleeping. So their environment is so dangerous that they cannot fully relax, so that even while you're sleeping, your body is physiologically ready to defend yourself from some danger that might be there. And so it was those experiences, as well as that reading of the literature, led me to think, how can we capture this? And so I had questions on this scale when we talked about the everyday discrimination experiences. Right after that, we said, in dealing with these experiences, how often do you try to prepare for possible insults before you leave home? How often do you carefully watch what you say and how you say it? How often do you avoid certain social situations and places? We're talking about people actively taking steps to protect themselves. By the way, another experience when I lived in New Haven that reminded me about this reality was a very good friend of my wife and I. He was a successful African-American young businessman. And he owned his own business, but he was young. He wasn't, I think, then in his early 30s. If his wife needed a gallon of milk from the supermarket, before he went to the supermarket, he would go into his bedroom and put on a tie and take a jacket and go to the supermarket to buy a gallon of milk for his wife. Because that was something he was doing to minimize the chances that he would be perceived as some thug. And again, what's the cost physiologically if you maintain in this vigilance, is the term I use, to constantly protect yourself?
So your efforts to quantify racism have yielded some very interesting anecdotal evidence. But we live in the age of Trump, and we live in an age where people are very resistant to not only quantitative evidence, but people are resistant even to the idea that race and racism should still be treated as a phenomenon that needs to really be examined and needs to be taken seriously. People, I think, at least in my opinion, are very dismissive about the idea. And also let me add, because we know that a lot of what you're talking about, even though you're able to quantify certain things, it is still subjective, right? So how do you respond to critics, and I'm sure you've had your share, who say this is subjective, it's you're misunderstanding people's motives and actions, and you're trying to quantify something that really is not really tangible and therefore quantifiable?
You've asked a really good question, and it's an important question, and it certainly was one we don't get asked as much anymore, to be honest with you, because the evidence, the empirical evidence, is overwhelming. the evidence that discrimination matters for health is overwhelming. And in the early days of the studies of discrimination, we were doing what I would call, from a methodological point, Dr. Wilson can explain this to the students who don't understand it, but these were cross-sectional studies. And we would have a self-report of discrimination. We don't know. It's not independent. It's the people's self-report. And we often, in those early studies, had a self-report of health. So we found that people who report high levels of discrimination have high levels of depressive symptoms. And so the question is, where is the causal arrow? Is it that discrimination leads to depression? Or could it be that there's a bunch of depressed people out there who are perceiving discrimination as not even real because they are depressed? And so they report the discrimination. So yes, you find this association, but where's the chicken and the egg? And which one is causing what? So those were, I would say, legitimate scientific questions that was asked. But one of the things I've learned about scientists is when a topic is uncomfortable with them philosophically, ideologically, their standards of scientific rigor rise even higher, and they become more critical of the evidence. So that in those early days, we had to build up the evidence that was to document that this matters. So first of all, let me say several things that happened. One was, there is, and I didn't do this work, but there's a lot of work by scientists in many disciplines that have conducted what are called audit studies of the nature of discrimination in American society. An audit study is, and I'll tell you about one of them, where you hold everything identical and the only thing you vary is the race. So, for example, Devar Pager, doctoral student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, did an audit study in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She took two African-American males and two white males, dressed them similarly, and gave them identical resumes to apply for 350 entry-level jobs in Milwaukee. One of the black males and one of the white males indicated that he was now out on parole and he had served an 18-month prison sentence for cocaine possession. So one of the African-Americans, one of the whites, had a criminal record. And what she found, and so they all went and to these establishments and handed in their resumes, and then she looked to see the results. What's the callback rate? She found what you would expect to find. Whether you were black or white, if you had a criminal record, you would be less likely to get a callback for a job than if your record was clean. But she also found what we did not expect to find, and that's why her study made it to the Wall Street Journal, and it was this. It was easier for a white male with a criminal record to get a call back for a job than an African-American male whose record was clean. The resumes were identical. And that's high-quality scientific evidence of the persistence of discrimination. There's been other work done by some economists in Boston where they sent out applications for African-Americans and whites applying to 5,000 advertised positions, real positions advertised in Boston and Chicago. But what they did before they sent out those letters and they made up some resumes to apply for these jobs, they went back to the birth records in the state of Massachusetts for the last 20 years and they looked at what names black parents tend to name their kids and what names white parents tended to name their kids. And there were some names that both blacks and whites use, but they tried to find what are the names that are almost used exclusively by African Americans and what are the names that are almost used exclusively for whites. And so what they did, they created identical resumes. The resumes had nothing to indicate the race of the person, but what they varied systematically was the names that people gave, whether they are typical black names or typical white names. And what they found was that if your name was a typical white name, like Emily or Brad, versus a black name like Tyrone or Shaniqua, you had to send out 50% more resumes if you had a black name to get a callback for a job than the same resume would get a callback with a typical white name. So I gave this morning in my lecture an example of discrimination in how long it takes to cross the street, done by Portland State University. So there's research like that has documented discrimination in bail, discrimination in how long that I run into a lot also, in whether a taxi is going to stop for you in a busy intersection in New York City or Washington, D.C., discrimination in renting a home or buying a home, discrimination in bank loans. So that in so many sectors of society, there's high-quality evidence indicating that discrimination exists and it's real. So that's one thing. We know the phenomenon is out there. Empirically, in terms of the actual scientific work that did, one of the early studies I did with colleagues at the University of Michigan was to take a longitudinal study. And we looked in this study at the levels of mental health problems. There was a measure of depressive symptoms and a measure of clinical depression. And at wave two, we looked at wave three. These people, we measured their reports of discrimination. And we looked to see, do people who are depressed in the past, 2 years earlier, and who have high levels of depressive symptoms, are they more likely to report discrimination when we interview them again? And we found no association between underlying psychological status, depression, clinical depression or depressive symptoms, and subsequent reports of discrimination. So it began to answer that question that reports of discrimination are not driven by the psychological state of individuals. And we've had many other studies that have statistically looked at relationship between discrimination and health, and statistically adjusted for what people would think might be the explanation. Social desirability, a certain style of responding to questions, or neuroticism, a psychological characteristic that might lead you to misreport stuff. And all of these studies show that even when we take these plausible psychological factors into account, discrimination still matters for health. The other point that I would tell you, in the early days of this work on discrimination and health, I could have counted on one hand the people who were doing work on discrimination, and they were all in the U.S., primarily working on looking at African Americans or Latinos. In the short 25 years of this work, there is a global body of evidence documenting the role of discrimination in virtually every European country looking at immigrant populations, in South Africa, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Brazil, in Canada. So we have scientific evidence. Literally, I have one of my students from South Korea who's studying this discrimination and its impacts on health of various subgroups within that society. So it's now a global phenomenon, and we have high-quality, longitudinal data documenting this pattern. So the critics can no longer question the evidence that's there, since we now have really good scientific evidence. One important point I want to make, and I think I can't overstate this point. I did not believe then, I do not believe now, that discrimination, the subjective report of discrimination, is the only way in which racism affects health. Racism is a much broader phenomenon than just the interpersonal discrimination you and I might experience. So the effects of racism on health also include powerful effects linked to institutional processes of racism. And this morning I talked about residential segregation, but we could talk about the incarceration of African Americans and the war on drugs that has been a war on the black community. And we can contrast the current public health approach to the opioid epidemic, which primarily emerges a problem of whites, where we didn't say, let's lock them up. We said, how do we get them care? How do we rescue these people who are dealing with a substance abuse problem? We didn't say that 25 years ago when there was a drug problem in the black community. And so there are multiple ways in which we need to think about the structural mechanisms by which racism, through its institutional policies and processes, creates unequal access to the benefits of American society.
Thanks for joining us for part one of my interview with Dr. David Williams of Harvard University, conducted on February the 8th, 2018, before a live audience in the Peters Media Center on the Oakwood University campus. Special thanks to Dr. Leslie Pollard, president of Oakwood University, Dr. Colwick Wilson, provost, and Ken Dixon, director of integrated marketing and public relations, for their support. Special thanks also to Damian Malone, WJOU's assistant general manager and in-house tech wizard, and to Brittany Matthews and Cherish Charles of the provost's office for their support and hospitality as we prepare to produce this episode. The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama and produced in partnership with Oakwood University Radio, Praise 90.1 FM, WJOU. Our theme music was produced by DJ Bailey. You can subscribe to the podcast at WJOU.org or on Stitcher, iTunes, or Google Play. I'm David Person. Until next time, be healthy.